Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I'm sure you recognize some of the issues. Ride sharing, charter schools, homeless housing, stand your ground bills. In many cases, these bills, which are introduced in the Washington state legislature and other state legislatures, didn't necessarily originate here. They are copied from model bills, which are introduced by various organizations and state legislatures around the country. And USA Today and the Arizona Republic have completed a two-year investigation. Rob O'Dell worked on this story. And Rob, how many bills are we talking about here?
Nationwide, we're talking about 10,000, more than 10,000 bills.
And these are copied word for word from a model, and then are they claimed as original bills, or do they disclose that, yes, we copied this from some organization that wants to see this passed?
We found bills that were pretty substantially copied, so they copied at least large passages of it, and it's often not disclosed. We interviewed more than 50 people, legislators who had introduced this across the country, and about half of them are just like, hey, this is how it works these days, this is not a big deal. A little less than half, you know, say, I don't know where I got the bill from. I got it from somebody else. I wrote part of it. You know, I don't really know. And then there's a small group of people who just say, I wrote this all myself, which sometimes can be questionable.
Now, how did you figure this out?
Basically, what we did was we downloaded roughly a million bills that were introduced between 2010 and 2018. And then we created a database on our own of model legislation that we have found across the country. And we compared that list of models to the list of legislation that had been introduced. We were trying to prove, you know, that this was happening at scale across the country, but how it's happening is certainly much larger than just what we've found.
It's no secret that states will copy each other. If they think they see a good idea in some other state, then they'll transplant it here. Is that harmful?
We certainly found this in a lot of cases. These bills were good bills, bills to help overseas veterans vote. I don't think anyone's against that. But where it sort of becomes a little bit more murky is if a corporation is pushing a bill that benefits them and that is not disclosed. One of the main pieces we talk about in the story is this asbestos transparency bill. Mm-hmm. It was a bill that made it harder for people who were harmed by mesothelioma to sue. And in that case, there were a couple of different model bills. One was pushed by ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And in some of the cases in legislatures across the country, a person was called to testify as sort of like an independent subject matter expert, and he was from that organization, ALEC, which had written the bill. So that's where you get critics saying that they don't think this is right.
You also tracked pro-gun control bills. Tell me about those.
We certainly did, and those end up in more liberal states. You wouldn't see this in Arizona, where I'm based, but in New York or Connecticut or Hawaii, you'll see bills requiring sort of like registration for firearms, or requiring like a you could only buy this many firearms in a particular period. Those bills end up in liberal states, and then you sort of have the opposite effect in conservative states.
So there is really no way you can know then, unless the legislators decide to disclose it, whether they are proposing something that was built from the ground up in the home state or just copied from somebody else.
Which is, I think, why we see the reaction to this story.
Another bill that you highlighted here, which looks like it was pushed by conservative groups, is the Campus Free Speech Act. What does that do?
So that is a bill that was in response to conservative speakers across the country being either heckled or canceled because of objections about what they're saying. It prevents colleges from denying those speakers. And if one of those bills is a model from the Goldwater Institute, and one of the things we had in the story is a legislator in Wisconsin just took Goldwater's model and gave it to the bill writing arm of the legislature and said, I just want this drafted as it's stated. The bill that they drafted was almost completely copied from the model that Goldwater had written.
Well, the danger would be if somebody took this model legislation and didn't even bother to vet it, didn't bother to read it, and simply introduced it because they felt under pressure to do it. I would have to assume that you would at least read what you were doing, because should it be passed into law and go haywire, you'd be in trouble.
Yeah, that's interesting. We interviewed the person who had passed the most instances of model bills, the most copycat bills in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And
who is that?
It was a representative from Pennsylvania, a representative named Thomas Mert, who is from the Philadelphia suburbs.
Uh-huh.
And he did sign on to many of these as a co-sponsor. And what he says he did is he read a memo on all the bills from one of his fellow legislators, and he didn't realize what the source of it was. And he said, well, I wouldn't ever know the source unless they disclosed it.
Uh-huh.
And he claimed to not know that any of these 72 bills were based off models. So we do have people who say that they don't know, because the guy who passed the most said he was really stunned to be told that he was the top sponsor in the country. So, I mean, so it definitely happens. Legislators, more than we'd like to know, don't read all the bills that they pass or introduce.
So I guess the only defense to that would be a vigilant electorate. Did you put up a database of any kind where people, if they suspect that a bill has been simply copied and pasted, you can type in the name of the bill or a phrase and find out if in fact it was?
Yeah, we're working towards that. At first, the database is going to our reporters at USA Today Network. One of the things we are doing that we're asking for help is we're asking for people, if they think they see a model, either in a legislature or just if they have a model that they found and they want to know where it shows up, we have a link to send us that legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll run it through our system and see what pops up on the other end.
Rob O'Dell from USA Today and the Arizona Republic. The story that he co-wrote with Nick Penzelstadler is called "You Elected Them to Write New Laws. They're Letting Corporations Do It Instead." Rob, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Hello, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. You spent all day just watching mainlining TVW? Or?
I do spend a good deal of my time this time of year doing that, yes.
I see the list of stuff the legislature's still got to decide on here, including plastic bag bans, marijuana convictions, the rape kits, of course, and still a capital gains tax. So where do you want to start?
So it's been a very busy couple of days in Olympia. Of course, we're winding down to the last few weeks of session, and there's a key committee deadline today. So they're just doing a lot yesterday and today. One of the big ones that did finally clear the committee yesterday is the statewide ban on single-use plastic bags. Now, this would require every retailer in the state to hand out paper bags at 8 cents each, or offer heavy-duty plastic bags that can be used at least 125 times or more.
How do you gauge that?
It's very technical, and it's all in the bill. I won't try to say it on the air, but there's a way. There's a way, okay. And it's something that they use in California. It's very specific.
Okay.
So you can't have the single use. You can have the 125 use. So
may I just do one thing? I mean, if you have a plastic bag that's heavy duty, and you don't use it 125 times, it's even less likely to decay, though, right?
Right.
In the dump.
Let me get to that. You're not wrong.
Okay.
So supporters say it's better for the environment, the bill, and that it's got the support of the grocery industry, in fact, which wants to see a statewide standard as opposed to right now. I think there's like 28 cities who have their own ordinances. So they want to see this uniform across the state, which is what this bill would do. But the paper and pulp industry has concerns.
If you want to ban plastic bags, fine. Ban them all, not just some of them. If you leave the heavy, thicker plastic bags in this bill, you're not eliminating plastic out of the stream. We got to drop the fee on paper bags.
If you look at a nearby city, Portland, Oregon, they did this. They just said, let's stop having plastic. And they didn't charge anybody anything. To remove plastic, why does the consumer have to pay for that? It just becomes a tax on groceries.
So, yeah, to your point, that was the one of the arguments against is that, you know, even if you use them 125 times or 50 times or however, you still have to get rid of the bag at some point somehow. But the idea is it's not a single use, so it's better for the environment, and they're really looking a lot at what California is doing with that same heavy-duty bag. And at this point, it still has to go through to the House floor, where there could be an amendment to deal with that, but I don't expect that will happen. It's also looking more likely that people with misdemeanor pot convictions across the state will have those wiped, cleaned, and vacated. The bill to do that was voted out of a key committee yesterday. It allows anybody with a pot conviction from 1998 to when we legalized recreational marijuana in our state, to request that that conviction, a single conviction, be vacated, and then they have to get it. That is a big deal. It's something the governor asked for. You know, we've done that here locally. I think Snohomish County has done it. King County has done it. And the idea is, you know, it's legal now. So that just can hurt people's chances to get housing, jobs, and other things if they have convictions like that on their record. So that is moving along. The one I wanted to give you an update on, we've talked about since before session started, was the rape kit backlog bill. They've made such big progress on this year, and it really just has a couple of final steps. But this, of course, would create that new lab down in Vancouver that would get our thousands of backlogged rape kits tested in much quicker. Right now, it takes up to 2 years. It would get that testing down to 45 days. This would, for the first time, require that all of those backlog tests actually be sent for testing, which they haven't been yet. It cleared over in the House. It needs to go through to the Senate. But the big question here was whether it would get the funding, because this gets more staff, more lab staff. It's like $13 million. Both the House and Senate released their budgets last week, and they both included money to fully fund this. So this is a big deal.
Right.
Moving
so once
forward.
This is done, then a bunch of people who thought they got away with it are going to start getting a knock on the door.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, possibly they're already locked up. We've seen that a few times, right?
Okay, capital gains tax. Where does that stand?
So there's a couple. We talked about the House version last week. Another one in the Senate. Now, the Senate version is not a part of the budget like the House version is. The Senate version is 8.9% on capital gains of $250,000 or more. And this money, where the House one in the budget would go for like education and mental health, this actually is used to give tax cuts to low-income people. It cuts property taxes for seniors, veterans, and things like that. It also goes towards the working families tax credit. It also eliminates the sales tax on feminine hygiene products and things of that nature. So it's very different than what we've seen before.
So is it designed to be actually tax neutral, you mean? So they would just, it's basically redistribution from rich people to people who need the money.
Yes, and just like we saw in the House committee hearing last week and the Senate hearing yesterday, we saw a lot of people come out who would have to pay this tax in support of it.
For the last 20 years, I haven't needed a paycheck. I make over $1 million a year from investments, and more than half of that is capital gains. For me and most people in my situation, that was the easiest money I ever made. It's pretty easy to make more, and much of it in capital gains. And I pay zero on these gains to Washington schools, Washington's roads, Washington's housing, its healthcare system. Those teachers, nurses, policemen, construction workers who didn't win the tech lottery, they'll pay up to six times what I pay in taxes to the state, which is totally unfair.
Now, that led to a little bit of a tense back and forth with Republican Senator Keith Wagner, who went on to ask this question.
Do you feel as if there's a barrier right now that prevents you from just writing a check to the Treasury if you want to help?
Yeah, the barrier is cultural norms. That doesn't work in this state. It doesn't work in any state I know of. It doesn't work in any country I know of. It doesn't work in any universe I live in. I think when we have a system and we want it to function in a particular way, then we should have rules for that system. And we just want our rules to be that we would pay our fair share.
And he wants that to go to the state and not, so.
That's an excellent point. And I don't know why people don't listen to the rich guys who are directly involved in this. We're always saying, why don't the rich guys just write a check? The point is, there's really no reason except that they don't, unless they're told to.
Right.
And here you have a bunch of rich guys saying, tell us and we'll do it, but we don't want to do it on our own. I think part of it is because, you know, you don't want to miss out on the yacht if you don't really have to. If other people are going to buy the yacht and you can't buy the yacht because you're being charitable, makes it just a little bit tougher to be charitable. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but apparently it does to the rich guys who are affected. So why not believe them?
Right. Well, and also, if you're just going to write a check to the state treasurer, how do you know what they're going to do with it? You know what I mean?
Well,
there's a whole lot of other issues.
But that's with almost anybody you give to the state treasury. But, of course, we're ignoring the elephant in the room here, which is that based on everything I've read, that would still be considered an income tax and therefore illegal. So did that come up at all?
It did not, again, as in the House hearing, come up during the debate, because there's not a lot of back and forth except for that one that you just heard there. But again, everyone has, I think the Freedom Foundation has already promised a lawsuit if either version of this passes. So this is going to play out in the courts should this end up being passed.
Is that in sort of a perverse way to make it easier to pass it, knowing that it would have to go through a court test before anything was actually done?
I think it's possible that there might be some who think like that. But I also think that this is a stepping stone too. So this, you know, if they can get a little further this year with this than they did the prior year, then maybe next year we get across the finish line. Yeah. But I think inevitably, no matter what, it's going to, whatever year you pass it, it's going to end up in the courts.
Is anybody talking about this as a nose under the tent for an all-out income tax?
No, but there are a few different bills. I mean, this talks about a work group to study this tax structure in the state. And I've seen that kind of language on a few different bills throughout the session that are still alive. That it, I think there's definitely a move down the line to look at that and make a work group and study what our tax structure is. So possibly.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott, our legislative detective.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's when tragedy turns to inspiration. You may remember the Mount Vernon officer, Mike McClory, who was shot in the line of duty. That was 2016. He was blinded in that shooting. You may also remember the story of 14-year-old Andy Isidoro, who was in the passenger seat of his mom's van as they drove on Highway 509 back in December, and he was shot at random. He's also now blind. Well, that teen, now a few months into his recovery and new life, had a request.
Officer Mike, this is Andy.
Well, hi, Andy.
This is Officer Mike.
How are you?
He said he couldn't sleep last night. He was so excited to meet you.
Can you give me a big hug, big guy? There you go. There you go. A little tighter.
Cairo 7 TV was there for the meeting. Officer McClory bonded with the teen. He showed him how to tell the difference between coins, feeling the ridges on some, and even gave Andy a 50-cent piece that was given to him by his parents.
It helps me to remember the most important people in my life. Who are the most important people in your life?
My family.
And on this day, 14-year-old Andy had a message for the person who shot him.
If he's listening, I would say I forgive you, but he made my family suffer and everybody suffer. I still have my dream to be a police officer like Mike.
You never know. You never know. So you just keep the faith, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
You heard him right. They still haven't caught the man or person, could be a woman, I suppose, that shot Andy, though they do have a sketch of a man police think may be their suspect. They're also open to the idea, though, that there have been multiple shooters along 509. There have been 11 in that same area recently where Andy was shot. They just need tips from the public to track down this person or persons.
Wow. Well, I'm glad they made something positive out of it, but it's... still pretty scary.
Yeah.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. March Madness is over. Virginia won. I lost interest after Gonzaga and the Huskies lost. So this is far more exciting.
The 0-1. Swing, clobbered, high, deep left field. Encarnacion, second time, same inning. Out to left here at Kauffman. He has homered twice in the sixth, and the Mariners now lead it 12-4.
Here he is from 710 ESPN Seattle, Danny O'Neill.
I got a little something for you. This might make you like Edwin Encarnacion here just a little bit more, beside the fact that he homered twice in the same inning.
Yeah.
First time a Mariner had done that since 2002.
Right.
When he trots around the bases, specifically around first base,
right,
he will put out his right arm at about shoulder level.
Right. Mm-hmm.
With an imaginary parrot on it.
Really?
Why?
He takes a parrot for a walk.
I like
it. Correct.
What does that mean?
Well, it dates back to actually a home run he hit against the Mariners, I believe when he was with Toronto.
Yeah.
And he kind of lost his balance as he came around first base, so he had to put one flap out to maintain his balance, and everybody said it looked like he had a parrot and it stuck.
It's a tradition now.
So when like he it. Homers, he takes the parrot for a walk.
What a fun name to yell to. Encarnacion!
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
It's a good one.
It's a blast, and he walked the parrot twice in one inning.
Walk yesterday. The parrot. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you'd enjoy that.
Let's get him to walk the parrot.
Bring out that parrot! Come on! Let me see the parrot!
Yeah. I like it.
Five home runs last night.
Tell me, why is it that the Kansas City didn't invoke the mercy rule in the sixth inning?
It's a great question. Just say no mas.
Yeah.
I also have a theory that I think would make baseball more interesting if you could bank runs. If you could take runs that you score
run
late
redistribution,
in the game,
yeah.
Right, and just say, we're going to save these for tomorrow. Yeah. We're going to apply these to tomorrow's
game. But that's
game.
A socialist approach to baseball.
Why is it socialist? Yeah. I think it would like reward the grasshopper for working ahead. Or was it the grasshopper that didn't? Yeah,
well,
it was the grasshopper that
if you want to do a financial
around and was the summer he was lollygagging.
No, I get it. But if you wanted to do the financial model, the runs would have to gain interest, so you'd have even more runs the longer you saved them. I don't think that baseball would go for that.
No, I don't want run appreciation. I just want you to be able to stockpile them, use them for a rainy day.
Huh.
You'd be able to explode them with. We would like to apply our five runs right now.
Well, could you do that? If you invoke that in the sixth inning, then they score more runs. Then do you lose?
Yes. You can't. Once you make the decision to bank them, you can't reapply them.
Now that's,
it would be awesome second guessing. Like, you were up 9-2, and we thought we'd bank some. Yeah. We ended up losing 10-9, and Skip, do you regret banking those runs? You're right, I regret banking those runs. If I thought they were going to come back and score any runs, I would have never done it.
How about redeeming them?
Yeah.
Could you do that once per game? If you were the banked runs that you had earlier, you use them in August. Say, I'd like to take the two runs from April 13th and apply them to today's game.
Oh my goodness.
You can only apply them against the team you're facing. You can only apply them.
So, like, in a later series?
You can't score them against the Sad Sack Angels and then apply them in a series against the Red Sox.
Oh, well, that's just ridiculous.
No, that makes more sense.
I hate to bring down the mood, but what happened to Felix in the first inning?
Flu-like symptoms.
Oh, okay.
We thought he got hit with a pitch. It was his birthday. He was sick. He didn't get hit. There was a ball that came right back up the middle, and it was very apparent after that D. Gordon knew that Felix wasn't right. And then he went into the dugout, and even before he got to the dugout, he motioned to the bullpen that he was done to let Chase and Bradford know he was coming in. But apparently he was pretty sick.
That's too bad.
Yeah, he was ill.
Well, at least it's not an injury.
Like, oh, no, Felix is going. Oh, please, don't go.
Oh, yeah.
Don't come back.
Well, you were saying the bullpen
now
was terrible.
Now we actually might win. Oh, yeah, we did.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Oh, no, too bad.
And by the way, Dan Vogelbach walked the park yesterday.
Dan Vogelbach did homer again.
Yeah.
The Vogel wagon.
Yeah. I see.
What do you think the Vogel wagon sounds like?
I have no idea.
No, like, apply some creative logic. Would it be, Dave Wyman thought maybe it was like the Flintstones car, where it was like the feet hitting the ground. I thought it was more of like a muscle car revving, like, perhaps it's a clown car.
I just have one more question. At the end of the season, could you trade in your unused banked points for the nose hair trimmer or not?
Still on these points.
These aren't green stamps.
You can use them as democracy vouchers
and use them to fund
different Seattle City Council elections.
$25 a bank run. Very good comeback. The Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western
Washington. I see your joke on redeem runs, and I raise you democracy vouchers.
Man, you win today's Sports Insider.
What do I get? Nose hair trimmer?
You get an invite to come back tomorrow.
See you then.
Let's talk wildfires on this rainy day. They have been pretty bad during the summer, and officials are now saying they need more resources to keep firefighters and communities safe, and there's a proposal in the legislature to help with that. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Dave, at a Senate committee hearing yesterday, Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Friends told lawmakers that the wildfire danger in our state is a crisis, and it is only going to get worse, as she pleaded with them to pass this bill.
We have very much a crisis here in Washington State, a wildfire crisis. It's a crisis that threatens all of us, from the east side and west side, urban and rural. It's a crisis that has cost our state $153 million annually to fight, and that doesn't include the cost to our economy, our environment, and to our health. But the cost that worries me most, the cost that keeps me up at night, is the cost to human lives.
Now, this proposal increases the tax that insurance companies pay on insurance premiums they collect for property and casualty insurance. It increases that tax from the current 2% to 2.52%, with all of the money from that increase going to the new wildfire prevention and suppression account. Money, Fran says, is desperately needed to protect communities and firefighters.
My job and the job of our firefighters is to protect our communities. My job is also to protect the men and women, some of them the same age as my eldest son, who put their lives on the line to protect us. It's getting harder for us to keep our communities and our firefighters safe. It's getting harder because last year our fire season began in early April, and our firefighters working 16-hour shifts were exhausted before the heart of fire season even began.
She says that's a trend that's expected to continue this year and continue to get worse.
Last summer, my team held our breath for 30 minutes after one of our DNR contracted planes went down in the Northeast region and we didn't know where the pilot was. Fortunately, we were able to find him and get him out safely. We also had burnover. Fires jumped the containment line and fire trucks were engulfed in flames. The firefighters escaped, but again, barely. In 2015, in Twisp, in Pateros, in Wenatchee, thousands of people were evacuated. tragically, you may all remember, we lost three firefighters.
And she says part of the problems is the firefighters, they don't have the money for the training and for the staff and the equipment that they need.
Nothing has substantially changed in the way our state funds wildfire prevention and forest health and suppression from 10 years ago to today. We are fighting fires with antiquated tools. Our helicopters are from the Vietnam War. We only have 7 of them to cover the entire state. And we oversee the largest wildfire fighting team, and we only have 43 full-time firefighters.
But as you might expect, multiple people from the insurance industry strongly oppose these tax increases, including Noel Sorensen with the American Property Casualty Insurance Association.
You know, insurers agree with the idea that dealing with wildfires is a terrifically important priority, but it's our view that it's a societal priority. It's not just an insurer's priority. 5996, unfortunately, has all of the funding coming from the insurance industry and from consumers of insurance products.
And he also warned that property and casualty insurance really covers like everything, right? Your rental, mm-hmm. your car, your motorcycle, motorhome, all kinds of insurances. And that cost is going to be passed along to consumers. But several fire chiefs also came out and spoke at this hearing. We have to have this money. We have to have this money. We're going to have Oregon. They cited a study that says Oregon and Washington are supposed to face the worst, highest risk of wildfire danger this season than anyone else in the nation, and they don't have the tools needed. They have to deal with the prevention efforts, dealing with the growth and all of that.
Yeah. So, I thought that was DNR's responsibility in the non-fire season to go around creating fire breaks.
And that is, and I think this specifically talks to, for that part of this bill, that money would go to non-DNR prevention and suppression efforts for that particular type of thing, dealing with that burn away, the brush. But the rest of it goes for firefighters, firefighting, emergency firefighting, a variety of things, forest health activities. One thing that came up in this hearing yesterday, one of the fire chiefs who was there was asked by one of the lawmakers, are we at risk in this state for something like we saw in Paradise, California last year? And the answer was yes. I think they pointed to Wenatchee, where something like that could happen in some of those surrounding areas. So this is a fairly new bill. It just came down on March 29th. It's the first hearing I'd heard on it. We'll see what happens. It'll have to get worked out in the budget.
Have I told you my rain barrel idea?
No.
You just take like millions of rain barrels and line them up at like a fire line in the forest. They fill with water during the wet season, and they have heat-actuated valves, like the, sprinkler valves. So, and some of these fires just travel through the trash on the forest floor, right? So it would creep up to the line of rain barrels, pop the valves, all goes out.
I don't know enough about those type of efforts, but it sounds like a good plan.
It's good enough for me. If you like it, then.
I think that Hillary Frantz thinks that they need some more.
Yeah. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
The big event in Washington, D.C. this morning is Attorney General William Barr, who's been testifying before Congress since about 6:30. The hearing is officially about the Department of Justice budget. But the other topic that keeps coming up is the Mueller report on the 2016 election. Here's what Barr had to say about that.
Within a week, I will be in a position to release the report to the public, and then I will engage with the chairman of both judiciary committees about that report and about any further requests that they have.
Within a week, but he is still redacting, and there are four areas being redacted. Grand jury information, information that the intelligence community believes would reveal sources and methods, information about ongoing prosecutions. I think we understand all of these reasons for redacting. And then number four.
And finally, we intend to redact information that implicates the privacy or reputational interests of peripheral players where there is a decision not to charge them.
Implicates the privacy or reputational interest of individuals. Let's find out whether he's talking about individual one or somebody else. David Farenthold at the Washington Post. David, how do you read that statement?
It's really hard to read this. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out what role Barr is going to play in this. Is Barr going to play the role that he once was, which is an experienced Washington hand, somebody who is a Republican but has been around Washington for a long time and believes in the rule of law? Or is he going to be a very Trumpy person and do like Mick Mulvaney and just protect Trump at all costs? I think when you see what he's chosen to do with these reactions, and he's going to treat Trump as a peripheral figure whose dignity and reputation should be protected, we'll know the answer to sort of how he views his role. role and how he's changed.
Yes, and that's what this sounds like. That he is preparing the Democrats in Congress to be very disappointed by the report. So at that point, what do they do without it looking like what it frankly looks like? Desperately trying to find something to use against the president for the next election?
Well, I think it's hard to know until we actually see the report. I mean, the whole investigation was about Trump and his orbit, so it's kind of hard to believe they could redact it in a way that would leave no mention of Trump or wouldn't be obvious, you know, what role Trump was playing. If they just redact the whole thing and, you know, there's a few ands and these there that poke out of the redactions, but there's nothing else, then I think the Democrats will be outraged. At this point, it's hard to predict what, you know, and you can't say how the Democrats should react until you know how much they've been denied.
On the president's taxes, which I know you have a particular interest in, the latest I'm hearing is that the state of New York is going to try to get his state taxes?
Yeah, there's something we've been talking about for a while. That in the federal system, there is a law, not very well used law, but a law from the 1920s that says Congress can inspect the tax returns of any individual for various reasons. So far, the White House has been blocking the IRS from surrendering those to Congress for Trump. New York State does not have a law, but it's trying to make a law like that, where state legislatures could view Trump's state tax returns, which would contain much of the same information. That law has just got introduced a couple days ago, and you can obviously see the potential for abuse there. If they Right. write a law that's very broad and says the state legislature can look at anyone's taxes for any purpose, it might cheer Democrats who want the Trump's tax returns to get out, but depending on how broadly that's written, it really opens the door for a lot of abuse by the New York State legislature in the future for people who are not the president.
And so if this turns out to be a dead end, the whole IRS thing, and if it turns out that the Mueller report doesn't have anything that the Democrats can use on the president, then can we just drop all this and do something else?
Well, what did you have in mind? No, there's a lot of other investigations, a lot of other questions we don't know about Donald Trump and what he did before he was in office, what he's doing now that he is in office. So, you know, the IRS, you know, I never saw Trump's tax returns, you know, that process as being something that they would ever give up Trump's tax returns through the IRS. They would fight that tooth and nail. And if he's only one-term president, I think they could delay it long enough that it'll never happen. Maybe the state taxes thing will happen. You know, just because these things didn't produce the results that Democrats wanted or Democrats wanted right away doesn't mean that they're not were good things to do and that other investigations of Trump shouldn't proceed. None of this says Donald Trump actually is a very moral man, totally above board. There's nothing left to ask about him. It just means it's these investigations are harder and turn out in ways different than we thought.
Well, you could shift over to Bernie Sanders. He's not releasing his tax returns either for some reason.
Can you believe that? And he didn't in 2016. He would make excuses. He said, someone forgot the key to the file cabinet. You know, Jane does them. She hasn't come home. And he never produced them. He dropped out of the race before showing them. And this time around, he keeps saying, well, in a few days, and he hasn't. I have no theory about what he might be hiding, but it is wild given how much attention Democrats have put on President Trump's refusal that one of the leading Democratic candidates so far has not.
I didn't know you did to Bernie Sanders. That's not
bad. That was not a very good one. Come back next week and I'll work on it.
Yeah. The Mar-a-Lago, the strange incident at Mar-a-Lago where someone described as a Chinese woman shows up with cell phones and thumb drives that have malware on them. That sounds pretty serious to me, but it also sounds incredibly obvious and amateurish to have been, you know, overseas espionage. Do we know anything more about that?
That woman had a detention hearing yesterday in Florida in which we heard a little bit more about the case against her. And there's evidence sort of on both sides. Yes, she was extremely incompetent if she was a spy. She, you know, talked her way past the front gate, which was some kind of accomplishment, but then blundered around and managed to get captured by the receptionist. So if she was a spy, she wasn't very good at it. On the other hand, she had a huge amount of electronics, malware, and a thumb drive. She was traveling with a lot of cash and electronics. It seems unusual for somebody who's just come over here for a business dinner or a few business meetings. I don't think the government has really figured out what her intentions were, but so far they have not given an indication that she's an actual paid agent of the Chinese government.
And on the whole border situation, we've been over the staff changes. It sounds like Stephen Miller is running the show. This is the White House policy aide who's is a hardliner. Would you agree with that?
Yes, there's been a huge purge of officials from the Department of Homeland Security, and it seems like Miller is the one calling the shots here.
Okay, here's what I see happening. We just had this court decision, right? A judge on the Ninth Circuit Court said that the president, in trying to send asylum seekers back to Mexico, is just breaking the law. The law is very clear. You have to at least give these people a hearing. You can't just send them back to Mexico. Trump has just railed about this decision. He says, look at this once again. As I read that decision, that makes his case for the wall, right? Because if sure. that is the law, if that is the law, that once you set foot here, we have to give you a hearing, and since we haven't got the capacity to give you a hearing, we essentially have to let you go, the only way to stop what's going on at the border is to build an impermeable wall that prevents people from setting foot on U.S. territory.
I mean, but the problem with that is that, you know, yes, he's talked about a wall, but what you're really talking about is sealing the border, not letting anybody set foot in the United States. And if Trump was willing to do that, you know, then I guess, yes, you could end the problem of asylum seekers, but you'd also shut down the U.S. economy. So Trump's talked about that, sealing the border at some border crossings or at all border crossings, and that would solve one problem, but it would create a whole host of other problems. Miller's thesis seems to be that the more hardship they impose on individual asylum seekers by separating their families, by housing them in tents, the more, you know, harshly they treat them, that somehow will filter back to Honduras and Guatemala and stop people from coming. I think last year's experience, where they were extremely harsh and cruel to people by separating families last summer, and then that was followed by a huge surge in immigration, proves that his theory is probably not right.
So what will they do?
I think, well, it's hard to know what Miller is calling for, an increase in family separation, separating even more families, housing people, families for intent cities at the border, treating them, you know, very, very harshly.
So going back to that.
I think expanding it, doing even separating even more categories of people from their children. And you remember what a debacle that was, because they had no system to track the children once they were separated, and took months, still taking them time to figure out who separated from who. And it also didn't work if the goal was to reduce the number of immigrants coming over, asylum seekers coming over. I think they're going to try an expanded version of that, and I don't see any possibility that it's going to work. I just, the experience shows us that the factors causing this are so much bigger than just, you know, can be solved by that.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Here it is, April, and boy, if you love the scent of fresh pavement the way I do, this is going to be your month, because a lot of highway construction is about to get underway, and it starts with Highway 2.
Yeah, I'm going to focus on Highway 2, because there's a lot going on that corridor east of I-5, working your way all the way over to Gold Bar. There's a lot of construction going on the rest of the map, and we'll get to that too. But you have a home improvement list at home, I'm sure you do, we all do, and then you blow it off and blow it off, and then eventually you're like, oh my gosh, look at what we have to do. Well, that's kind of what it's like on Highway 2 right now.
We are repaving it, resurfacing it, working on the bridges, replacing expansion joints. You name it, we're working on it between Bickford Avenue and Gold Bar.
Francis Federisco with the Washington Department of Transportation says contractors are going to add a 4 to 6 foot wide median between the east and westbound lanes between Bickford Avenue and the Pilchuck River Bridge, which is basically just the east end of Snohomish. But to do that, they're going to have to squeeze the lanes a little bit.
Currently, the lanes are 12 feet wide. We're going to reduce them to 11 feet wide, and that gives us the extra space that we need to be able to make up that space between the opposite directions of traffic.
So it might seem a little counterintuitive, because we're going to reduce the lane, which you might think would be, okay, that's a little more dangerous, but they're creating a wider buffer, a median in the middle, which eventually is going to have some cable barrier on it. So there's a method to their madness. Now to the Pilchuck River Bridge itself, which I mentioned is just in the northeast of downtown Snohomish. It's getting new expansion joints, which I'm happy for. It needs them. They haven't been replaced in 40 years. But this is where drivers are really going to feel the pain, because when they close this baby down, they're going to close it down to just one lane for full weekends.
We will have the bridge reduced to one lane, which means that it'll be alternating traffic with flaggers. That will be over the course of two separate weekends. And there's no great alternative route in the area.
Those weekends haven't yet been set. We're assuming they'd be sometime after June, when we know we get steady long-term periods of warmer and drier weather. Now, the westbound lanes of Highway 2 at the Trestle, also going to be closed for two more weekends later this year. You remember that paving project that tried to get started all of last year and kept getting rained out. Well, they only got to four of the six weekend closures that they needed. So they've got to do it two more weekends.
Northbound drivers, you're going to have to take State Route 9 up to Marysville. Southbound, you're going to have to take it south to 96 through the north end of Mill Creek. It's going to result in those major backups. Last summer, we had 30% diversion, and we still had those backups.
Those dates and those weekends haven't been set either, but I would anticipate those to be in a similar time frame once we get past. We know when summer starts on July 5th around here. Looking at further east on Highway 2, you can expect some resurfacing work and some core sampling to test the depth of the asphalt as you move out towards Skykomish.
They're taking core samples from the shoulder just to see what kind of asphalt's been laid down in the past, how it's been holding up, what changes we can make as we move forward with a new design for that part of the corridor.
So that's going to set the stage for some paving work in the coming years, heading east of Gold Bar and working your way out to Skykomish. The bottom line for Highway 2 users, as we know, especially those of us in the north end, we like to go recreating. Highway 2, you can go wherever you want to from Highway 2. It gets really busy during the summer. So that means you're going to have to prepare for delays, which there are already delays coming back on weekends, as we all know, through Gold Bar and whatnot. But you just have to be prepared. We might have some weekend closures in there to deal with. Keep your head on a swivel. Highway 2 is going to be very full of orange cones this summer.
Remember I brought up the prospect of self-healing concrete a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
Has there been any progress on that? Because it seems to me that if we're going to really call ourselves a high-tech society, I mean, I've got all the scrambled word apps I need. Somebody needs to get down and invent a self-healing concrete so I don't have to patch it up every 40 years.
So in other words, something like the battlefield dress they came up with early in the Iraq War that made out of like oyster shells or whatever that they would put on, and it would actually heal and grow and work and basically cut the wound from bleeding anymore,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So if we can do that for bandages, why can't we do it for
exactly
asphalt? Somewhere out there, there is a 9-year-old entrepreneur who's going to come up with this. Too late for the time you and I are driving,
I know,
Dave. But yeah, that seems like a very
good idea. If we can inspire that 9-year-old to make it his life mission that we never need to go through another summer repaving episode, then his name will live on in history.
Well, I can put my daughter on it for you. She's 5. She's got some time.
Fantastic. She's got some
interest
in there.
Science.
There we go.
I'll put her on it.
Well, you know
what more does she have to do?
What we really need to do is prevent rain, because that's what really cracks the pavement.
No, we need rain to keep the place from burning down in the summer.
They do have that absorbent.
See, there's every solution. You've got a problem, Dave.
We already have absorbent asphalt.
And I had the rain barrel problem to fix the wildfires earlier in the hour.
Right, now fix the roads with your
you
rain
barrels.
You should
tune in more often.
No, I listened. That was actually quite when you both and Hannah went,
that's right, exactly
as the water released.